This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for being with us on our Main Street across the state of North Dakota today. And we're going to start our show by talking about a new novel by a writer by the name of Raymond Strom, who's from where we live. He was born in Hibbing, Minnesota. He has moved around the Dakotas, lived in Williston and Minot for a little while in Wisconsin. And he joins us from New York City, where he works as an academic advisor at City College of New York. Raymond, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
This new novel is titled Northern Lights. What spurred you to write it?
My whole life, I guess, sort of led up to that. I was moving around a lot when I was younger, and I lived in about 10 places before I started high school. And it's all a sort of combination of all of those towns. I wrote about a town that is like my whole childhood all at once, more or less, and that involves some pretty crazy things, I guess. The sort of dissolution of my family, and then later the things that followed that. I had some time in drug treatment as a teenager, and that all sort of plays into it. And then also in my high school town, there were a number of people who decided to put together a Confederate flag parade in 1997. And so those are the main events of the book overall, is sort of the meth epidemic and some crazy stuff going on at that same time.
Well, in the promotional materials for the book, you're quoted as saying, "I lived in normal, quiet towns, but I was drawn to the darker side."
Yeah, I definitely was. I'm not sure why. It just sort of worked out that way. So we went looking for the extremes, really, and we found them. And a lot of that is in the book.
This takes place in the summer of 1997, and the fictional town that it takes place in, or where it starts, is home, Minnesota. And your central character is Shane Stevenson. Tell us about Shane.
Well, Shane Stevenson is a long-haired, androgynous-looking boy from Grand Marais, Minnesota, and he's looking for his mother. So he has just graduated from high school, and he's on his way to college in September at the University of Minnesota, and he, after getting kicked out of his house by his uncle, he decides to go looking for the mother that left him earlier. And so an old return address on an envelope he got on a Christmas card leads him to home, Minnesota, where he finds that she's gone already, but the super of her old apartment building allows him to stay there, so he decides to take up looking for her and ends up running into a couple of people in town, making friends and also some enemies.
When Shane Stevenson eventually goes on to his education, do you think he becomes a writer?
The book's written in first person, so he must have written it at some point.
So what got you interested in writing in the first place?
I was always sort of interested in writing. I remember when I was in fourth grade in New Ulm, I had a teacher named Mr. Otto, New Ulm, Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he had us all write assignments, draw pictures of what we wanted to be when we grew up. And there were a lot of pictures of baseball players and football players. And then I drew a picture of me sitting at a desk from the back writing. Wasn't the most exciting assignment, I guess, but I guess I did it eventually.
Well, it's interesting that you were bitten by that interest so early.
Yeah, the first book I remember reading was like a copy of Stephen King's Salem's Lot that was missing like 50 pages here and there. And I don't know, from then on, I just read the portions of that book that remained and then just kept reading forever.
I can imagine you filling in those 50 pages. What's your process when writing a story, when inventing something like this?
It was a sort of a long process. I like to start in notebooks, and I'll write 3-4 pages a day and then not look at it, and then write 3 or 4 pages the next day until I have like a good month or two, and then I go back and read through for strong ideas, repeated ideas, themes that I'm clearly thinking about that I was maybe unaware of, and then I move that stuff into my computer, and then I write from there. I try to write every day before work. I've somehow talked my boss into letting me come in at 11 every day, so I try and write from 7 to 10 every day. I wake up, feed my cats, drink some coffee, and then I type and then come to work at 11. That's pretty much it. I try and keep it in there sort of contained because writing can take over your whole life when you let it.
So you kind of write this stuff and let it percolate for a while. But are you creating a plot line and connecting the dots, or did you start with the first sentence that informs what follows as you discover the plot?
Oh, no, it's a lot more scattershot than that, I guess. I write a lot, and then eventually I find that first sentence in the full notebook, and that's where I would move forward from.
You know, typically when I talk to an author and a novelist, I ask what's more important, the plot or the character. I think in this case, it's pretty obvious the character is pretty important. And there is a lot of, you know, reviews that have been written about the book already. It just came out last week, but there's been a fair amount of promotion around it. You found a very good publisher, Simon & Schuster. And I'll read just a couple of these. The search for identity, both familial and sexual, is at the core of this outstanding debut. The powerful bonds of at-risk youth are vividly portrayed and movingly rendered. So, did you have a search for identity?
Did I?
Yes.
Yeah, I definitely was searching for identity apart from my family, I guess. Like, when I was a teenager, I had a lot of identity issues because my family broke up, and I thought that that reflected something about me. But eventually I think I figured out that, you know, I'm still a person anyways, right? So, that was pretty tough, and that was only part of it, I guess. But definitely there was a lot of soul searching as to who I was in the world as a teenager. And I had a lot of identity issues just in my appearance. I was sort of unsure of myself, who I wanted to be. And like that sort of showed in my presentation. I wasn't really the snappiest of dressers, and I'd let my hair grow long, and that sort of drew the attention of other people in the same way that Shane receives attention in the book.
So you might not have been a member of the most popular clique in high school?
Yeah, not necessarily, no.
Did you have a typical reader in mind as you were writing?
I guess I was sort of writing to those people, new adult people just around graduation who were going through the same identity issues as me. A lot of that stuff came together for me in college. I had a couple great professors at Metropolitan State University and at Minneapolis Community College that really, like, stopped me and told me that everything was fine and I just needed to keep going. And that was very helpful. So I want to be one of those voices for those kids who are searching for the same thing that I was.
Then you went on to City College in New York to get your MFA, right?
I did, yeah. I love public school. and now I work here. So, yeah, really, I really believe in public school and the humanities and arts for public school students. That's a big part of my life now.
Well, you advise students, don't you?
I do, yeah. And I work in the Division of Humanities and the Arts, so I have a number of creative writing students that I advise, a number of philosophy students. That was my other major as well, so I always really like dealing with those two types of students, but we also have history majors and theater and art and music as well, and so all of the arts are really my favorite place. This job is really good for me because I really like to encourage people to read and to pursue the arts, and in New York it's easy to do because there's theater everywhere and music venues and a lot of writers. So yeah, it's working out pretty well. I really like it.
Sort of the nexus for an artist's life. When you advise students interested in writing careers, do you have some sort of boilerplate advice? I mean, sort of the rock bottom, this is what you should do regardless of what else you decide to do?
I do have a couple of basic things that I start with. And the first thing is that writing takes a really long time, so you're going to have to find another job to pay the bills while you're writing your book.
And you did.
I did, yeah. It's 2019, and I graduated from my MFA program in 2009, so I definitely needed a job for those 10 years. And I still need one because, you know, in the end, writing isn't the most lucrative for most writers. Some people make it big, but it's...
Raymond Strom is the author of Northern Lights. It's a new novel, and it's his first novel. Why did you pick 1997 as the time when this story takes place?
Well, 1997 is the actual summer when in Cambridge, Minnesota, there was a Confederate flag revival staged by my classmates in high school. It all just sort of built out of that. I sort of fictionalized that moment and changed it a little and then built everything out afterwards. From my research, it seems that the sort of height of the meth epidemic was in the 90s in the Midwest, although I know that it's still going on and there are still people with serious meth problems and stuff. But that was just the time I wanted to cover, partly because that was the time I was most familiar with before I had moved away from all of that.
I remember that incident. I was in the news business for a long time. And can you describe for our listeners what happened and what resulted from that?
There was a student who had brought, welded a Confederate flagpole into his truck and then drove it to the school and parked it in the parking lot so that it would hang in the truck all day. And some teachers had told him that he shouldn't do that for whatever reason, and it turned into an argument that eventually became a First Amendment issue, and he got suspended for not listening to the teachers, but then he and a bunch of his friends gathered together a group of 20, 25 people and paraded up and down the streets with their Confederate flags, and they called the news, and that they were interviewed on the news that night in the parking lot of the mall in my hometown. And so I guess that sort of caused a rift between people in the high school. Some of us thought it was ridiculous, and then other people thought that it was definitely worth fighting for.
Well, it's the Civil War continues to be fought sometimes. To some folks, it's a clear symbol of treason, and to others, it's some sort of symbol of independence or rebelliousness or something.
Yeah, it's an anti-American government thing in a way. I guess I could see that as well. But yeah, in the end, there are other meanings, and you have to deal with all of them, right? When you have a symbol like that.
What did you learn about writing as you were putting together Northern Lights?
One of the things I learned is that a lot of this stuff happens subconsciously. There are things that, after I had finished it, I had friends read it, and they're like, oh, I really like what you did in there with that Christina's World painting. And so apparently there are three distinct scenes where I sort of describe Christina's World by Andrew Wyeth.
That's a famous painting, yes.
It's a woman on
a field looking at a farmhouse in the distance.
That's right, yeah. She's sprawled out in the grass, and she's looking off at the house in the distance. And I didn't even notice that I had put that in there, the perfect three times. You always want to have images come up three times so they're visible and memorable. And so a lot of that stuff, once you get going, you sort of know what you're doing, even if you don't know what you're doing on the surface.
Sort of the rule of three in speech communication. You're taught to mention the theme three times in your communication. How about the name of this character, Shane Stevenson? There's a movie called Shane, and please don't go, Shane, is the famous plaintive line from it.
I just really liked that name. It's not from the movie or the Western series.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like the connection, though. That sounds nice. Another accident, I guess.
Well, let's talk about finding a publishing house. How did you pitch this to Simon & Schuster?
Well, I was very lucky. Let me start at the beginning. So I graduated in 2009, like I had said, from my MFA program. And then I didn't really write too much because life got in the way. I needed a job, and I couldn't get much writing done. One of my friends, though, he had been running a literary magazine, he and his girlfriend at the time, the two of them. And they were starting up a new one, and they put out an Indiegogo campaign where they were asking for crowdfunding to start this new magazine, and I really liked the work they did, so I gave them $25 and thought that would be it. But then he asked me for a story later on that day, and I was like, I don't have anything because I had quit writing. But then we had known each other for years from grad school, and he was like very specifically like, well, what about that one story you told me about the Confederate flag? Maybe you should write that. And so I went back to my notes where I had already written a bunch about it, and I pulled together this story. Sisyphus and Lucifer, which they ended up publishing in that magazine. And one of the magazine's interns also worked at a literary agency, and this intern brought a copy, and then the guy that later became my agent picked it up off the table and read through it, read my story, and instantly got a hold of the editor so he could get a hold of me. And then we worked together for 3 years drafting through novels, and then one day he was like, this is ready. And, you know, he knew this editor, Ira Silverberg, at Simon & Schuster, and we had pitched it to a number of other places, but he sort of had his eye on this one at Simon & Schuster, and then it all worked out. So it was really great. A lot of people have to do a lot more work, and so I sort of lucked out. It was really nice.
So the big break is finding that agent, an advocate for you in the business.
Yeah, an advocate who knows people already and knows who to ask. He's really good at it, too, Adam Eaglin, my agent.
Well, you're a writer, and of course writing is sort of a solitary thing, and we get really attached to the words we write sometimes. Perhaps you do, too. So what's it like to work with an editor saying, don't do this, try this, that kind of stuff?
Certain people I don't like to listen to, but these two editors like really knew my story and really knew what it could be, and they were always, these two were more into asking questions that would lead me to make my own decisions. And some editors are really bad where they'll like mark your manuscript in red, cross everything out, say this is horrible. But these guys are like, maybe you should rethink this. And so I would. They had a very gentle editing style, both of them, but it really worked well for me.
So you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force him to drink. So they had a way to lead you to where you ended up, huh?
Exactly, yeah. So somehow they got me to drink. Anyway.
Well, your book came out last week. How's it doing?
So far, so good. A lot of people are reaching out to let me know they like it and hearing some good things. I had a release party in New York at Kinokuniya Books here, and that went well. It was another crazy snowy day last Tuesday, but still 40-some people showed up through the sleet. It was pretty awesome.
Well, are you working on something else?
I am. Not to give any spoilers or anything, but I have a couple characters that just disappear from Northern Lights. But they will reappear later in stories of their own. And the one I'm working on right now is about one of these characters who, after running, he also has to run away from this whole scene of what's going on in my book. And so fresh out of college by way of jail and drug treatment, this other character ends up in New York where he meets a woman who asks him to give him more than he is able. And that's sort of as far as I've gotten so far.
Well, the book is filled with colorful characters, including Shane's mother and a guy by the name of the Fisherman who is not a fisherman. I look forward to reading more about what you do. Raymond, it's an interesting book. It's fun to read, and it really moves when it gets near the conclusion. It's a a pulse pounder, if you will.
Oh, great. That's great to hear.
So, Raymond Strom is the author of Northern Lights. You can find out more about Raymond and the books he writes at RaymondStrom, that's STROM.com. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up next, Natural North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson about the Constitution.
My sense is that in the year 2019, the Constitution of the United States is going to be a big and central issue, so we're beginning to examine that important document through Mr. Jefferson's eyes.
We asked many questions, most of them provided by our listeners, about the Constitution, including how Mr. Jefferson would advise our generation to rewrite it.
As you know, Mr. Jefferson said we should tear up the Constitution of the United States periodically, perhaps once every 19 years, and start fresh. So just what sort of suggestions would he have for us?
We ask him how much of it is written in stone and what can be interpreted.
Jefferson was a believer that the Constitution existed for the happiness of humankind, and it was not a sacred document.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we appreciate our listeners, so thanks for joining us today. It takes a trained eye to notice some changes in wildlife. Chuck Lura has a trained eye, and recently, more birds of a kind than usual caught his attention. Today, his Natural North Dakota essay is about the snowy owl.
I recently traveled west from Botno on Highway 5 around mid-morning. By the time I got to the Highway 14 turnoff to Kramer, I'd seen four snowy owls, most of them in the first half of the 11-mile stretch. I've not kept records of my snowy owl observations per mile, but that has to be some kind of record. I did a quick internet search to learn if an eruption is occurring this winter, but that came up empty. As many of you know, snowy owls are a species of the tundra, and like many other birds, and some North Dakotans, they often head south for the winter. Some range maps show their winter range covering the tundra northern coniferous forest ecotone, southward across much of Canada and into the northern border states. So we generally see a few each winter, but they are also known to move in mass southward during the winters in search of food when the populations of their main prey, lemmings, plummets. Historically, the lemming population cycled in 3 to 4 year intervals, which made predicting those eruptions quite predictable. Some of you may recall that an eruption of snowy owls in the United States occurred during the winter of 2011-2012. The birds came down in force, making national news, and several sightings were well south of their usual destinations. That eruption was different. That was caused, scientists discovered, not due to low lemming populations, but because of an unusually successful breeding season. Young males could not establish territories in their usual breeding range, so they wandered southward in search of suitable territory. There is some evidence that the cyclic nature of the lemming population may be a thing of the past. Some lemming populations in northern Europe have not been exhibiting the characteristic 3 to 4 year cycle since the mid-1990s. One of the factors scientists are investigating is a change in snow. Not the amounts, but the type or structure of the snow. The Arctic is cold. That would be expected to produce dry, soft snow, which falls to the ground and forms a blanket on the vegetation above the ground, leaving an open space between the ground and the big white blanket above, in which the lemmings could spend their winter somewhat protected from the cover of the snow. But these days the temperatures are a bit warmer, the snow a little wetter and heavier. The space between the ground and the snow cover above that helped the lemmings thrive during the winter. That may be gone. It'll be interesting to learn what the scientists continue to discover and how this may change the lemmings, snowy owls, and tundra ecosystem. In the meantime, there are a few snowy owls in the state this winter, so be on the lookout for them as you travel about. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a cutting-edge podcast about a good outcome from a change in school schedules. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has rejected a bill that would require candidates for local elected office to declare a party affiliation. Normally, local candidates run without a party ID, and local government officials want to keep it that way. West Fargo Republican Representative Austin Schauer.
The main point of opposition to House Bill 1375 is this. Local leaders want to avoid partisanship and remain bipartisan. In the end, the committee viewed 1375 as picking a fight with the locals, and we decided not to do that.
The bill's sponsor, Minot Republican Representative Scott Lauser, says he introduced the measure in the name of transparency so local voters could have an insight into the candidates' ideologies.
All politics is local, so let's stop hiding behind an outdated law and pretending that it's not. And by the way, Mr. Speaker, I heard in small towns everybody already knows somebody's political affiliation, so there shouldn't be a problem here.
The bill failed on a 53-37 vote. Operation Prairie Dog has passed its first test. The measure provides oil tax money for cities, counties, and townships for infrastructure projects. It cleared the House on an 80-12 vote. Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nathy is one of the sponsors.
This is money well spent. This is an investment back into the communities of North Dakota.
But Bismarck Republican Representative Rick Becker doesn't like it.
I think this is a bad mechanism. It sets a precedent. As a previous speaker noted, there's no sunset. When the money isn't there anymore, the cities and counties are going to be crying that we cut them. And now what are they going to do? Well, I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to raise taxes.
The Senate will take it up after crossover. And this week is Through with Chew Week, or the Great American Spit Out. It's a few days dedicated to awareness of the dangers of smokeless tobacco. Jordan Schaefbauer is a tobacco cessation specialist with Bismarck-Burley Public Health. She says it's important for everyone to remember that there are no safe forms of tobacco, and in many cases, smokeless tobacco is far worse.
Some of the dangers of smokeless tobacco use are esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, oral cancer, and other problems like heart disease, and also addiction, because one can of chew is equal to four packs of cigarettes.
Schaefbauer says, unfortunately, rates of smokeless tobacco use in North Dakota are higher among minors than adults.
Our youth smokeless tobacco rate is at 8%, and our adult smokeless tobacco rate is at 6.2%. And a lot of that has to do with the different flavors and marketing, because smokeless tobacco and e-cigarettes and those kind of products are all flavored, like different candies, gums, fruits, and things that really appeal to kids. And so that's why a lot more kids are using them.
Schaefbauer says events with Through with Chew Week not only help raise awareness, but also highlight opportunities for smokeless tobacco users to quit the habit for good. She says resources can be found online at ndquits.health.nd.gov. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. How effective is a school? That's an important question, and the answer is especially important for students. Today we have an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast about a success story involving the elementary school in Cannonball and the high school in Solon. The schools recently received a national award for exceptional academic improvement after their school year switched from semesters to trimesters, because after the change, graduation rates increased. Host Tom Gerhardt spoke with Superintendent Justin Fryer and math teacher Vanessa Peach.
It's a big award. It meant a lot to our staff and our community and our administrators, but it really focused on a couple key areas. At Solon High School, it was due to such a big improvement in our graduation rate. One of the big initiatives with Superintendent Basler has been Native American graduation rate. She hasn't been okay with it, those numbers being so low as compared to other ethnicities' graduation rates across the state. So we've shown quite a bit of improvement in that area, and you know, we continue to look to improve as we go forward. So that's what really set the stage for the high school, that we've shown so much improvement in graduation rate. Here at Cannonball, a big part of it was just going above and beyond for a special population of students and the demographics that we're faced with. So we're really honored by the awards. We're doing a lot of things well here. Obviously, we can always get better, but I'm just really, really proud of our staff and our community and our school board and everybody for buying into what we're doing. And we're hoping to keep the momentum going as we move forward in this process and do what's best for the kids that come to school here.
Vanessa, you're here at the elementary school, and Superintendent Fryer just mentioned going above and beyond. I know you're not the only one, but what does an award like this mean for the teachers here?
I think it's just nice to be recognized, and not only from like our administrators, but in a national sense that, you know, we are doing things for the students and we are here for them.
Justin kind of teased a lot of big things going on here, and I just wanted you to talk about, it seems a long way off now as we sit and look out the window at the snow, but a new elementary school, broken ground, you said you hope to start construction this spring. Congratulations on that. That's a big deal.
Yeah, Tom. So we were awarded a federal impact aid discretionary grant to fund a new Cannonball Elementary School. As you mentioned, we broke ground. We've got everything lined up. We're hoping to start construction on this new school this coming May, we'll say, just based on the weather. It'll be the first new school in Cannonball in a number of years. Parts of our current elementary school date back 80 years. So, you know, we're just really excited for that too. And we only think it can enhance what we're doing here. It's going to give our teachers and our students just a much better learning environment to thrive and be able to succeed in the 21st century.
Especially like this time of year where the temps are so low, we have indoor recess, but right now our only space to have them is in our classroom. So it consists of watching a movie. Well, as you know, kids need to get their jitters out. So it'll be nice to be able to access the gym and use that for an indoor recess environment and have a separate lunch area and the size of the classrooms to accommodate more students and be able to have different learning areas within the classroom and set up for their different needs and things too.
Justin, you mentioned that Cannonball Elementary is an Apple Connect school. And when you think of a new school, of course, you think about technology upgrades, increased space. You said the classrooms will be for up to 25 students, so you have some opportunity for growth. But just talk about technology and what's going on in Cannonball and Solon in terms of technology now and moving forward.
Cannonball and Solon High School are both one-to-one schools. Cannonball Elementary is an Apple Connect Ed school. It was a grant that we applied for and were awarded a couple years ago. After President Obama visited our school, we applied for the grant. We're awarded a grant through Apple. So the grant really focuses on 21st century skills. And what it does is it allows our teachers to be able to provide innovative teaching and instructional services to our students in the sense that all students have their own iPad. Teachers are able to use a multitude of programs and platforms to meet the learners where they're at and also provide unique problem-solving applications for the kids. So it's really, really been helpful to basically individualize instruction for all of our kids here at Cannonball and also over at Solon High School. We're one-to-one over there as well. But we're really hoping when we move into the new school just to enhance that by having more space, you know, having a brand new computer lab, having more supplementary classrooms where we can, you know, work with our kids, our gifted and talented kids, some more with these programs, some kids that need some extra interventions to have some more unique interventions set up. So it's really going to help us provide that platform and really help us focus on creativity. And also we're looking to partner. We do partner with the Sioux County Extension Office down here, and we'd like to further enhance that partnership. Currently at the high school, we have a business they run in the back. They do graphic arts, screen printing, embroidery. So we're looking at bringing some of those things over here to the elementary and just helping our kids be more career ready.
Not only are we able to access different apps and things on the iPads for the students to help with their math and reading skills, we can also access our curriculum on there and do different things. Like, it's reading month right now, and one of the goals is to have the students create a video encouraging other students to read. And so I luckily got to create my own video, which it's kind of cheesy, but hey, it's a good way for the students to be able to express themselves and get things out there too. So there's a lot of different things they can do with them.
Justin, you mentioned at the elementary and high school that enrollment has increased. Talk about that a little bit and how there is growth in both schools.
Yeah, so we're up about 33 kids this year, pre-K through 12. So that's been really, really nice to see. We tend just to see a lot of families coming back from around the reservation, moving back into our district and also just staying here. We've in the past had a very high transiency rate where kids will go between schools here on the reservation back and forth. But what we're seeing is a good number of kids staying for the whole year, which I feel is better for the kids. And also we're seeing more kids just interested in coming here. I think they're getting a sense of the synergy and all the good things that are going on here. And then looking at our parent and student surveys, they seemingly come back higher than our teacher surveys, which is a really good omen that we're doing things very, very well here. So I think the enrollment will just continue to grow. As you know, when you get a new school, everybody's excited to come to the new school because you'll have the new gym and the new classrooms and all the new technology. So it's just an exciting time.
Justin, you had mentioned as we were emailing back and forth a pilot e-nurse program in both schools. Flesh that out for a little bit. Tell us what's going on.
Just due to our rural location, we have found in the past that it's very, very hard to provide our students with nursing services, meaning that we're not able to get a school nurse. So we partnered with Avera out of Sioux Falls, and each school now is basically equipped with an electronic nurse. Students can go into a designated room where this device is set up, and they can video call in to a nurse. I believe the nurse is located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, if I'm correct. And once they call in, they can do things like check their temperature, you know, look in their throats, diagnose infections, just do a lot of different things. We use it for some of our kids that are diabetic, generalized questions and concerns for parents. So it's really allowed us to provide not only preventative service, but also unique services to our students. And the whole goal of the program was to keep our students more healthy so that our students can be in school more and keep our attendance rate high.
Also, the elementary school here in Cannonball, you said, will be piloting a new 21st century pre-K program next year for four-year-olds, and that's critical, I'd say, in getting those kids going and integrated into a learning environment.
Something here in Solon Cannonball that we're really trying to focus on is our pre-K program. As you know, a lot of research points to just how essential these skills are. We want our kids to come into school being kindergarten ready. What we've done is we're going to partner with a company out of Utah called Waterford, and it's going to be a state initiative. There's going to be some pilot schools in the state, and there's going to be some other states across the U.S. that are going to be piloting this program. So what the program will do is it will provide a Chromebook and free internet to four-year-olds who attend Cannonball Elementary School. And this program will give an assessment, a baseline assessment to these students. And then the program will automatically set up interventions in reading or math. And the students will work on those interventions at home with their family. The families will be assigned a learning coach to help them monitor and progress with the kids. And our hope is that this program will make our students more ready for kindergarten when they come. So we're just really excited to be able to provide this program, not only here at Solon Cannonball, but also out in the rural community that we have here in Sioux County for our parents who not only don't have internet, but just, don't have the ability to get to town for different interventions or transportation. So it'll be unique.
Vanessa, what does that mean to you when you eventually get these kids to teach? How important is this?
Having the kids kindergarten ready, and having that assessment early on, we can meet some of their needs of the basic, just knowing numbers and one-to-one counting and things that some other students maybe already have, but we can develop them. So hopefully we're all starting at a more even area, and then we can move forward.
Justin, the trimester schedule is something you've mentioned too, and in my encounters or travels across the state recording the podcast, not a lot of trimester schedules, but this is something that you've pointed out that has been really successful here.
The goal of the trimester schedule was to give our students more opportunities to get credits towards graduation. And also it gives our students a chance to take more electives. So what we've found is a couple key things is our students are more apt to complete their required classes. Even if they have a hiccup along the way, we have more opportunities for them to go back and pick up that credit, say in English 9 or Algebra 1, where they can go back and pick up that credit and then be able to move forward. And the other great thing about it is it's allowed a lot more electives for a school our size. We have 24 teachers here between Cannonball and Solon, so it's just created a lot more opportunities for our teachers to use their unique skills and offer a lot of classes that we weren't able to offer in a small school district before. And we found that it's helped us with our attendance because students are more likely to come to school if there's at least one class or two classes that they really like. So it's really helped us with our graduation rate.
Is this a way to help not allow students, I guess, to fall through the cracks? Are you catching things?
Yeah, if we're able to offer more things, we're able to reach more students. I mean, not everyone has the same likes and interests. And so if there's a wider variety that we're able to offer them, I think we're able to reach a lot more of the students.
And you mentioned, I just thought I'd point this out too, Justin, that the students do have the ability to access dual credit courses with both Sitting Bull, you said, and United Tribes. So that's fantastic as well. Let's talk a little bit about, you wanted to mention the professional development, and I think it's really critical when you look at some rural schools with a place like Solon and Cannonball and how critical that is. I mean, there's so many different ways to access PD these days, but what's happening here?
We've really focused on professional development, I would say, for the last 4 or 5 years, just using a lot of federal dollars, Title II, RLIS grants, just a lot of small grants, any type of grant where I could write and get those extra dollars to focus on PD. And what that's allowed us to do is it's allowed us to not only send our staff to really solid local PD events here in North Dakota, but also provide in-house PD services to our staff at both schools. And then furthermore, we've been able to send staff across the nation to really big PD events like ISTE, a big technology conference. Last year was in Chicago. ASCD, of course, is renowned for their different conferences, just a couple big ones that we went to and some other ones as well. And I think what it's allowed us to do is really see what other schools are doing well across the nation with similar demographics as to what we have here. And like I always tell the teachers, and the administrators when they go, as long as you can bring one thing back, I always wanted to focus, just bring one thing back that can make you or the school district better than the conference has paid for itself. Sometimes I think everybody goes and they want to try to bring everything back, which is great in theory, but if you can just bring one thing back And I think that's really, really helped us not only as a school district, but it's just really been great for our teachers. And I feel that I did mention, you know, that we'd only lost like one principal and one teacher in about the last 5 years. And I think that's a big part of our success is that teachers feel that we here at the school district value what they're doing. And they just really, really appreciate these opportunities to go out and get better. Because as we know, teachers want what's best for their kids, and we have to provide them with the training to be able to do that.
I know this last year I was able to go to the Apple Connect Ed conference down in Arizona, and it was amazing. And to be able to learn from the different schools, and like you said, Justin, with similar demographics to us, to see what they're doing, what's working in their school, and then bringing back stuff here that we can try in our school. It's great to be able to go out and continue our education too.
Justin, you mentioned RTI, and there's a lot of acronyms and things that people probably don't understand. We talked a little bit about the demographics, but what are you doing? You said you're refining that process, and that's for at-risk and, yep. and students and doing some interventions.
Yeah, so response intervention, you know, you have kids in different categories, tier one, two, tier two, tier three. So we just started the process. We sent a team down to Houston, Texas here, I believe last week or the week before, memory serves me correctly. And we sent educators and one administrator from both Cannonball, and the administrator was from Solon High School, and our data coordinator. We have a data coordinator also, which is unique about us. And they went down there. And we're going to look at refining how we're doing RTI. You know, we're doing a lot of things well, but with this process, we want to be able to reach more of our kids at an early age to help them be successful in our school system. So just another thing that we're really trying to refine and have great interventions. Before we label a kid, we don't want to label a kid as special ed. We want to try to keep kids out of special ed or those programs if we can. We want to try to, you know, get kids on track and get them caught up with their classmates.
There's lots of students that we have different interventions in place to try to get them to where they need to be. And if we can get them hopefully caught up before the third grade, you know, that's better off. But we still have students that maybe aren't caught up yet. And so we just continue to try to get them where they are. And if we can meet them where they're at to build those skills, because they're just going to continue to fall further and further behind. And we don't want that.
Justin, you know, we've talked a lot about what's happening in classrooms and outside of classrooms and with education, but extracurricular activities are a big deal. And you mentioned giving students more reasons to want to come to school, and that's a significant part of it. Talk about what you've done to expand what you're offering in that arena too.
Yeah, we've really done a lot here the last couple of years, just expanding what we do for extracurricular activities. We co-opted with football with Standing Rock down in Fort Yates. We've added a volleyball team to our high school. The big one that we just did, we just built a brand new softball field that's going to be ready to use this spring. And I know the kids really wanted to get on their last year because they could see the new grass coming up last fall and stuff. But we added girls softball, believe it or not, which is a huge thing for our female athletes. So we will, last year was our initial season. We'll be coming back for year two this year. So we're really excited to have the new softball field being used in Solon. So it'll be really unique.
I'm actually a coach for the fifth and sixth grade volleyball team and the junior high team. And we try to teach them not only, you know, lessons that they need to learn on the court, but we want to teach them that education is important, that comes first. And then there's the extracurricular. We form some pretty good bonds with the kids, too. And they come to us not only during the season then, but for other things. And I think that's a really big part, too.
Yeah, being able to model yourself as an adult for student athletes is a significant piece of the equation.
I think just to piggyback, I think she kind of hit a little bit, but you know, we've really focused on mentoring here too. And I know she mentioned a little bit with the coaches, but we have mentoring programs in place here. And what we've done is we've tried to assign each student, particularly at the high school, with a teacher or someone at the school they feel a connection with. And I think that's really helped us just with our attendance and helping the students as best we can when they're dealing with something in their lives, just having that one person to talk to so we can get them help or be that person they can talk to. It's really, really helped us develop strong bonds with the kids and their families as well.
And you mentioned the parent and student satisfaction surveys that have come back as you're trying to continue to build this atmosphere here in Solon and Cannonball.
So yeah, we do a bunch of different surveys, you know, per Title I requirements and advanced ed requirements. Most schools in North Dakota do. And it's been really, really unique and actually really, really good. All of our surveys have come back very, very well for both the parental demographic and our student demographic. Actually, what we find is our teachers generally rate us the lowest, and the students and parents rate us significantly higher. So I think that just goes to show you that we're doing a lot of things well. But at the same time, what our teachers are telling us is there's always things that you can do better. So let's just keep the momentum going forward and look to do things better if we can. But I think we can all be proud that it seems like we're making a difference. And I think that's what all of us are in education for, is to make a difference for our students.
Vanessa, what do those surveys tell you as an educator?
Forming the bonds with the families. I know we talked a little bit about the turnaround. There hasn't been as much turnaround. You know, we're here and the families know us and we see them out at different events and making those connections too. I think they feel like safe and they feel good sending their kids here and know that we look out for them too. It's good to know that they think of us like that. I know we're harder on ourselves than others.
When you're on the front lines day after day, sometimes it's good just to zoom out and look at the big picture. You take a lot of pride in what's happening and what's been happening and what the future looks like here in Cannonball and so on.
Yeah, I love it. I love coming to school and the kids, as soon as they see you, hi, Miss Paige, you know, running up, giving you hugs. And that's what we're here for. We're here for them. And to see that, you know, they care about us being here too. Not only, I know there's times where as staff, we will talk about, you know, I notice so-and-so is maybe not doing so well right now. So when you see them in the hallways, just recognize them. But they make us feel special and loved.
And Justin, I mean, in your years here, if you go back to when you came here, and certainly it's not you, it's a team effort, but there's been some dramatic transformation taking place.
Yeah, I think a lot of it can be attributed to, like I kind of mentioned earlier, just us being able to retain high quality teachers and administrators. We've been very, very lucky to find really, really good people who care about kids and want what's best for kids. And we really try to focus on shared leadership and giving everybody a voice to help us be better as a school district. But I think it really comes back to our personnel and just having such great personnel. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to do all these great things that we're doing here if we didn't have good people working.
I couldn't agree more with that. You can go to anybody and they're willing to help you. Yeah. And that's just so good to have.
Vanessa Peach and Justin Fryer, thanks so much for joining me. We wish you great success moving forward.
Thank you.
The Cutting Ed Podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, and entrepreneur Ted Dentersmith. You can learn more at ndunited.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Easter Seals, Goodwill, ND Inc., providing support for children, adults, and families in need across North Dakota, thanks to donated goods at their Goodwill retail stores. Learn more at esgwnd.org, because a better community starts with you. And by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring the Cityscape Ballroom for weddings with a view overlooking downtown. And spaces for bridal showers, rehearsal dinners, and gift openings. More information is available by calling the Radisson at 701-232-7363.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 20th. These days, we don't have to wait for our news. If something happens on the other side of the world, we know about it instantly. But on this date in 1919, North Dakota newspapers were still full of war news, even though World War I had been over since November. Ole Olson, an early settler in Cavalier County, shared the news that his son Peter had been honorably discharged and was returning home with 18 citations for bravery. One incident during Peter's time overseas involved acting as a guide for General Pershing, who was taking a tour of the front. The Germans fired a rifle grenade that landed within 5 feet of the general. Without thinking, Ole threw himself on the grenade. Fortunately, it was a dud and didn't explode. Consequently, he was able to return safely home. Other North Dakotans were also returning. The USS President Grant sailed from France with the 164th Infantry. The unit was formerly known as the 1st North Dakota. The North Dakota boys landed in Newport News, Virginia. From there, they went to Camp Dodge in Iowa, where they were discharged. There was also news of Stanley Walker, who had left Langdon on October 1, 1917. He served in the Air Corps and was training to go overseas when the war ended. His family was glad he wouldn't have to go to the front. But not all the news was so happy. Quentin Blair of Fairview and his wife received a telegram informing them that their son William had died in a French hospital. William had spent a year with the American Expeditionary Force in France. He survived the fighting, only to die of pneumonia on January 25th. It was also learned that Charles Corrigan, a Langdon boy, had been killed in France the previous August. He had served on the front less than 2 months. The Presbyterian Church of Langdon also held a memorial service for two of its members. John Robertson and Finley Ramage had both answered the call to serve their country and never came home, dying in France. There were 60 stars on the service flag in the church, one star for each local boy who went to war. Five of the stars had been changed from blue to gold, signifying those who had died. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority, and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan, on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Expect change and expect action.
Robert Lighthizer, the man in charge of trade talks with China, grew up in a small Ohio town. Did its economic decline make him a skeptic of free trade?
He knows how people have suffered by losing jobs, and that's part of why he went into that part of the legal profession.
Where a hardball trade negotiator is coming from, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll get a news update from South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Kara Hetland. The legislature she covers is dealing with issues familiar to us in North Dakota. That includes transgender rights, firearms on campus, sports betting, industrial hemp, and other issues we have in common. Sue Balcom will join us for another Main Street Eats to talk about in-season vegetables. And we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.